The one relates to apologies from Mrs. Carter and also from Mrs. Nyalungu, who cannot make it for today's session. Okay. No. This is an apology from Deirdre about Mrs. Tichitero. So not from you, from another Deirdre. I just read Deirdre. Kind regards, Deirdre. Sorry about that. That is a standing apology that we always have from UCDP. I'm not too sure what rules say on a matter of this nature wherein a person has never set, you know, her foot in a meeting, but we always have, you know, standing apologies. I'm not too sure what the rules say. Under normal circumstances, in any organization, if a person is not present on three occasions, without an apology, that person is eliminated from participating in that particular organization. But on an instance wherein the person is permanently on an apology mode, I'm not sure you must advise us on that one, because it also deals so much with our own, you know, decorum as a committee, and also, you know, quorum related matter. That's the first part. The second part is that we did in our last meeting request the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries to furnish us with the even if it was to mean an in-camera session on the security plan, insofar as abalone poaching is concerned. And also, we did impress on the department that we need to have a revised offering, if I may use those words guardedly, of course, that relates to the experimental, you know, catch on abalone. If I remember, it was reopened in July of last year, running for 6 months period. Now it has since been extended for another 3 years. Now still on the same terms, 150 tons. Nationally, 10.5 or 11 somewhere for the Eastern Cape over 7 zones. An example being given of one particular zone having to be allocated 1.5 ton, comprising of 130-odd beneficiaries. Now, that was categorically stated that is not sustainable, viable economically, and really playing with the sentiments and of our people. So much is expected, as it were. Now, on those two issues, we are informed that the department is not ready to present to us, despite the fact that we did impress upon them that they should, you know, present. I'm not sure if anybody from the department except you, Meneer. Where is Ralph? Did I see Ralph here? I don't know whether you want to express yourself on this particular one, because I don't see anybody else from the department, which then also will take us to another, you know, apology from the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform, that they figure out in accordance with our program on the security, land security, land tenure security bill that is on the table, that we are not having them today as well. So it means, therefore, that we'll only have one area that we'll have to deal with, which is what we see on the screen there. You want to have a quick one, Ralph?
Many members, many here. Chair, the message you sent yesterday regarding the briefing was shared with the DG, and DG said he would need enough time to work on the presentation, so they couldn't come and present it today.
Were you saying the message I sent yesterday?
Yes, Chair. The message that came through DNL regarding the fisheries briefing.
No. This is a message of our... This is a decision of our last meeting. It's not a matter that came only yesterday. In our last meeting, we agreed that we needed to have this briefing today.
There was a message which came yesterday, which then will mean the fisheries branch would know about the briefing pertaining to the decision which was taken in the last meeting. And DG was only reacting to the message that I showed him yesterday.
Comment?
Shocking.
No, clearly, Chair, there is a confusion here. I think it needs to be sorted out. Maybe the message was not, I don't know, but there is a confusion somewhere. There is a confusion.
There is not supposed to be a confusion. The Deputy Director General acting briefed our committee last week on Tuesday, among others, on the status of the ABRO, the experimental exercise that was engaged. That's where this matter comes from. It's supposed to be a clear-cut matter that says the DDG reports to the department accounting officer and the minister or the ministry. Whether there was a message yesterday or not, it's neither here nor there. So that's the point I'm trying to express across. So it shouldn't really be a matter of whether there was a message yesterday sent through. It was only a reminder. If it was a message sent through to you yesterday, a reminder of a decision taken last week by this very committee, to a point where we even express a need that if need be, we have such a session in camera. Wait for what? Suggestions, Mrs. Carter?
Chair, thank you. You know, I know that I've had a long-standing apology for a long time as well, but on the management, on the damage-causing animals, the last presentation, the department was also not present. Okay, this is except now for all the other matters that we need to deal with. And this was an urgent matter that we felt needed urgent attention. And I really feel that we should say to the department, they need to be here, they can't be here, then let's go back and until such time that they can actually be here. We need to now start setting and putting the rules down and the regulations down and say, we can't have the same person presenting here the whole time and we don't get to the answers because the department is just not here.
You're taking it forward now. You're taking it further. The point where we now have to deal with what we are going to be expecting to receive.
Commentary, I would really say we've got this presentation, you know, once again, I don't know what the difference in the content is, but the last time that we had the presentation, the department was not here either. So I'm really saying, what is the need of, what is the use of having the same person coming presenting the same presentation to us, and the department is still not here? So my suggestion would really be that we say we adjourn this meeting until such time that the department can actually be here and do what they are expected to be.
Mr. Udwe?
I beg to differ on adjourning it. I think we must proceed with what we have and go through it. Any information that we get, even if there's questions which the department is not here to answer, at least we've considered it and had some information. Because we can't run Parliament, you know, by just postponing our meetings and our work if the department doesn't pitch up. What's going to happen is, with oversight, I'm sorry to differ from you, Israel, but what's going to happen is that they're going to stall us. It's like SCOPA. People don't rock up, you know, to be fired. So what are we going to do if they just keep on not, you know, they're not rocking up?
I think we're dealing with the matters now holistically. My understanding of what Mrs. Carter was saying is that the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries has to have an opinion on these matters, to a point where ideally here we're supposed to have had the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries being the one that starts to present, so that we get a feel of what the issues are. You are correct, Mrs. Carter, in saying that we are likely going to get the same briefing with your name again, Mr.
Ramsey from the Department of Agriculture.
Mr. Ramsey.
Mrs. Carroll from Environmental Affairs is presenting this one, because it's actually their piece of legislation.
Yeah, that's the challenge that we have. We are also informed that there are other pieces of work that are being done outside of what the department is presenting. The gentleman behind you, was quite anxious, you know, to present to the committee his views on the matters. But we have to follow a procedure. This is typically a briefing from a government department on a process that is started. Among others, what we agreed upon in our last session with yourselves was that if we can, let us avoid to issue out these norms and standards and having, you know, those published, you know, around December, you know, period wherein nobody is around or is to be expected to have access to that information. Now, I was informed that that happened against those wishes. In other words, you went ahead as the Department of Environment and Water and published those norms during that time. Members, we are in that situation. I want guidance from some of us here. Dr. Postman?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think you're quite right to be disturbed about the fact that we didn't have a full delegation from the department. I think we all feel the same about that, and we support you in that situation, that we need when we get presentations from the department, obviously they should come with their people that are the experts in that field and give us some briefing. So I share your problem, and I can understand that you are upset about it, and so are we. I think we feel the same, and we support you in that. I think at the moment, to make the best of this situation, I support my colleague that we get a briefing, because we know that this is a subject that will still take some time to be finalized, and it's only draft norms and standards, and it will be discussed by the industry outside, and eventually when it comes back, the department, well, obviously, as you said in the beginning, they must have had very good information and maybe their own ideas on how to manage the situation. But obviously, we know in practice that with the inputs of the various stakeholders, some of the issues will probably change. So I supported that we get the presentation, and that we avail ourselves with the information that is contained in it, so that we at the following meeting, and then when we actually then get down to a draft that is more in the final phase, that we can definitely be in a position that we will discuss with the department and be informed from their side of what the different opinions are, and that we then at that stage have a better opportunity then to liaise and maybe change views within the situation. So I would support it that we go ahead, that we get the presentation, and then obviously I think we can maybe ask a few questions if it's necessary, but more of an information session, that we treat it as that. Thank you, sir.
Members, let's not take more time. I guess we just have to go ahead with the processes. If you don't mind introducing yourselves, and then we take it from there.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Tia Carroll. I'm the Director of Regulation and Monitoring Services in the Department of Environmental Affairs. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity. Unfortunately, at the previous occasion, we could not attend the meeting, so I would like to use the opportunity to brief you as requested in the invitation letters. I will be going into detail into the different sections of the norms and standards so that we can have some sufficient debate and discussion afterwards. So just a brief overview of my presentation, sort of a problem statement of why there's a need for these norms and standards, the process of development to develop the norms and standards. I'll briefly discuss a legislative overview because it's important for the committee member to understand the context in which these norms and standards were developed, the purpose of the norms and standards, and then the provisions in detail, and then a conclusion. Now, basically, it's a broad problem statement. It's far more complex than I can capture on one slide. But due to the general extermination of larger predators or apex predators, It led to the increase in the occurrence of other predators. This is linked to also the persecution of these animals like black-back jackal and caracal on farmlands and so forth. These all have trigger effects that just cause a population increase and so forth that has obviously cumulative effects in terms of the impact that it has. Now, the majority of livestock losses involves goats and sheep, and it's mainly black-back jackal and caracal that are accused of causing these losses. But unfortunately, there was no uniform provincial legislation or national legislation that sort of guided in terms of the management of these damage-causing animals. Now, as far back as 2006, there was a big workshop where all the stakeholders came together and discussed this issue. And it's taken a few years to get together all the information and come up with at least some form of guideline. Now, the process for the development, in January 2009, a task team was established to cooperate and consult in terms of the development of a document called Norms and Standards. The soil team include a variety of representatives with the National Department of Environmental Affairs as well as provincial representatives from the environmental departments, the National Department of Agriculture, members of the agricultural industry, conservation and animal welfare organizations, as well as academic institutions. So this group contributed to the development of the document, and then we followed the due government process in terms of the approval process for publication. So it was approved by Working Group 1 on 20 April. I must mention that this was now the second or third time it was presented to Working Group 1. It wasn't adopted the first time. It was sent back for review. So it's a process that's come a long way. It was adopted by MINSEC on 7 May 2010 and by MINMEC on 8 July. Then we had to submit it for the Minister's approval and signature for publication for public comment. It was signed on the 24th of October, and shortly thereafter the President made some cabinet shuffles, so we had to resubmit, and it was signed by the new Minister on the 13th of November. And yes, we continued with the publication on the 26th of November. We were aware of the problems in terms of the December traditional holiday period, so the Minister also signed an extension notice on the 31st, that was published on the 31st of November, that allowed the public to then give comments until the end of January. Now, to understand the context in which the norms and standards were done, I have to just briefly touch on the National Environmental Management Biodiversity Act. Now, in terms of the Act, the Minister may publish a list of threatened and protected species. And that list of threatened or protected species are then regulated in terms of a permit being required to undertake a restricted activity. And killing an animal or capturing an animal or hunting an animal or translocating an animal are all restricted activities which require permits. And then furthermore, the Minister may also issue norms and standards to ensure the achievement of the objectives of the Act, including for the management and conservation of biodiversity. So the norms and standards is part of the Biodiversity Act process, and it links to the threatened or protected species list and the regulations associated with that. So in terms of the threatened or protected species regulations, we have a definition for what is a damage-causing animal, and that is an individual of a listed threatened or protected species that, when interacting with human activity, there is substantial proof that it causes losses to stock or to other wild specimens, causes excessive damage to cultivated trees, crops, natural flora, or other property, presents a threat to human life, or is present in such numbers that agricultural grazing is materially depleted. Because this definition was already in place in terms of the TOPS regulations that's been implemented since 2007, this definition was adopted as is for the norms and standards. The management options that we allow for in terms of the TOPS regulations is capture and relocation by the authorities, which is the provinces or the management authority of a protected area, control or killing by the conservation authority or the management authority of the protected area, or capture and relocation or control by a person authorized by the provincial government. So the provinces can give someone else a permit to relocate, to capture and relocate an animal or to kill it. But it specifically provides that the hunting of a damage-causing animal cannot be done by a foreign client. So you cannot bring someone as a hunter from overseas to come and shoot a damage-causing animal. That is prohibited. A permit is, however, not required if you take action to, if there's a threat to human life. So in self-defense, you can shoot a damage-causing animal if it threatens human life, but that must then be reported within 24 hours. And in terms of TOPS, we allow for certain methods that can be used for damage-causing animal management. It requires a permit, but it's only allowed for damage-causing animals. You're not allowed to hunt an animal by making use of any of these methods. And that is poison, baits and traps, dogs, only for flashing and retrieving, not for the hunt itself. Darting for translocation, you must use a suitable firearm. You can lure, you can use motorized vehicles and aircraft, and you can use flat and spotlights. So those specific exceptions were made in the TOPS regulations for the management of damage-causing animals. And then, specifically, gin traps have been prohibited. But what should be noted by the committee is that gin trap has a specific definition in terms of the TOPS regulations. It's a leg hold or foot hold trap made up of two tightly closing jaws, a spring of sorts, and a trigger in the middle without an offset jaw or padded jaw that reduces chances of injury to animals. So it's got a specific definition, and I've got a photo of something that is prohibited. So in terms of law and implementation of law and interpretation of law, if a trap doesn't adhere to that specific definition, it's not considered a gin trap that is prohibited. So other forms of traps can still be used. And you can see that in terms of the regulations, certain methods are allowed. But there's nothing to guide provinces and landowners on how they must use those methods that are allowed. You say that you need a permit and that you can use certain methods for damage-causing animals, but there's no guidance on what is minimum requirements or minimum standards when you use that. And that is why we developed the norms and standards, to allow for us to say, in terms of top certain methods are allowed, but if you're going to use them, it must be used based on the requirements in the norms and standards. It will also assist the provinces in developing their own policies, because it must be based on the norms and standards. As I said, provide minimum requirements for the lawful use of the methods and equipment, and also then it provides for guiding principles, which is very important. In terms of the guiding principles, we focus on the fact that it must adhere to the applicable legislation. We want to promote the implementation of an integrated and holistic management approach, where the target is on the specific individual causing the damage, and the assurance that other management options have been implemented before it's needed to take action. And the action must also be orientated to prevent further damage or to mitigate the potential for further damage. The method to be used must be ecologically acceptable. We want a minimum impact in terms of the impact on the species and the environment. It should be socially acceptable in terms of the overall society must have understanding of why the methods are being used and so forth. And then the cost incurred to manage damage-causing animal should not exceed the value of the actual damage caused. Then there's a strong focus on awareness raising, ensuring landowners know what alternative methods are out there for them to use to protect their livestock. And those are more focused on non-lethal methods that doesn't require a permit. And then there's the other guiding principle is that stakeholders must accept that there's an inherent risk in having land adjacent to areas where predators occur, and that there will be some conflict to some degree. And that governments must also accept that they have a responsibility to intervene when damage do occur. And then we also would like to promote the use of incentives, giving incentives to farmers to tolerate predators on their farms and to maybe apply non-lethal methods rather than the lethal methods. And that will include marketing mechanisms and so forth. Now, if I can go to the specific provisions of the document. First of all, it's required that the issuing authority, in this case is the Provincial Conservation Authority, it provides that they must respond to complaints timely and proportionately to the severity, so that landowners are ensured that they will get a timely response and action based on when they do have damage. An inspection has to be done and a report has to be compiled in terms of that. And based on the report, which includes information on the damage caused, the interventions already put in place by the landowner and so forth, the issuing authority or the province must then propose measures to address the situation. And that can be either lethal or non-lethal. As I said before, it can include live capture. It can include permanent removal through euthanasia or translocation or putting something in a captive situation, or it can include killing the animal then. Translocation, we're trying to promote that translocation only be used when there's no scope for resolution. If you can't come up with other solution to that problem, because it does further impact in terms of opening a space for other predators to move in and disrupting the whole ecological processes. But a permit is required, if it's a top-listed species, to move that animal, so you need to get a permit. And then we included provisions in terms of consultation of the landowner and adjacent landowners, because you don't want to remove an animal to a land where it will cause problems for the next landowner. So we included in the norms and standards, if you want to translocate, that there's some form of consultation must take place between the different landowners to ensure that the impact is not, or the problem is not moved to a different area. And then very importantly, record keeping in terms of where animals are moved. Then there's a section on deterrent methods, and this is where we're trying to promote the use of non-lethal methods. No permits are required, and it's promoting best practices in terms of managing your livestock and so forth. So the methods that we're promoting is fencing, collars that can be used, king collars and bell collars and all those different collars, herding techniques, maybe using, making use of shepherds, that's not being done really these days, or livestock guarding animals, for example, the Anatolian shepherd dog, and so forth. Donkeys are here also work very well. Repellents and scare tactics. And then general management practices, stock rotations and so forth, in terms of how you manage your livestock. And we would like to emphasize that maybe a combination of these management techniques and techniques and deterrent methods will have the most effective result for the landowner. Then there's a section on the restricted methods. And what you must understand is that this section of the document speaks directly to the provisions in the TOPS regulations where we say you can use certain methods to control damage-causing animals, but it requires a permit. So in the norms and standards, we went further to say, for those that you do need a permit, we're going to specify the minimum requirements so that everyone knows if you want to use a trap cage, poison collars, darting, call and shoot, soft traps, dogs, there are minimum requirements that must be adhered to. So what is important for all the restricted methods is a permit is required. Only trained persons may use the method, and then they must adhere, when they use the method, they must adhere to this minimum requirement. So in terms of trap cages, I didn't include everything in the document. I sort of tried to highlight the most important ones. You'll see for all the methods, there's a requirement that it must be inspected and approved by the issuing authority before it can be used. There's a requirement for monitoring. You must check the cage regularly or at least every 24 hours. Once the animal is caught, it must be translocated, released, or euthanized immediately. It mustn't be kept in the cage for days on end. You cannot display the animal if it's in the cage. And then it specifies the requirements for the trap cages. The sizes must be species-specific. The frame must be covered with some material to prevent escape. And it must have safety catches so that, for example, baboon and so forth cannot open the cage. The poison collars, included that only compound 1080 can be used. It's a biodegradable poison, and it doesn't cause secondary poisoning. What is important is, in terms of the TOPS regulations, we say that poison can be used to control damage-causing animals, but we don't say how. So people can actually go and poison a carcass and leave it there. So here, in the norms and standards, we restrict it to the use of poison collars, and it must be used in terms of the Hazardous Substances Act, which got a specific set of regulations on how this must be used. So we're trying to control the use of poison for DCAs in terms of this by specifying how it must be used. So once again, the device must be inspected and approved, and once the animal dies, it must immediately be removed, buried, or destroyed. And then in terms of darting, the provisions in the norms and standards will have to be aligned with the Veterinary Council's new policy, which says that only a vet is allowed to dart an animal. So this is mostly to translocate the animals. Then cool and shoot. The provisions are very thin at the moment, so we hope that through the public participation process we'll get some information to beef it up a bit. But we basically say that the province can set some conditions that must be applied with, and records of all hunting events must be submitted so that we can get some information in terms of how successful it is and how many animals are actually hunted. Soft traps. I know a lot of people don't use like the word soft trap because it's all but soft. Maybe we must use steel trap or something. But it's a term that's used in America for the gin traps that they use, so I think it was just adopted from there. But we use the term soft trap to explain traps that doesn't comply with the definition of a gin trap, which is prohibited in terms of the TOPS regulations. So this is a specific section of the norms and standards that will require that a lot of comments have been received on, and that we will have to rework very carefully and consider whether it should be retained or not. And if we retain it, how will we implement what will be the final recommendation requirement? Once again, the device must be inspected and approved. There's some minimum requirements. The size and the type of the trap must be target specific and selective, so you won't use this size trap to catch a jackal. You will use the appropriate trap. There must be a screw to adjust the tension of the pan so that you can exclude certain foxes, bat-eared foxes and so forth. It must leave space, must have an offset jaw, so there must be space in between the jaws to allow movement of the limb if it's caught. The chain that attaches to the ground must have swivels to prevent the chain from coiling around the animal or twisting around it. And it must have a spring to absorb some shock. And then, very specifically, we specify that it cannot be placed in certain specific areas. For example, you cannot place a trap in a hole in the fence, alongside the fence, close to water holes, so where there's a lot of trafficking of other animals as well, because then you will not catch the correct animal in the trap. So these are just some pictures of some traps that we have. This one is the padded or offset jaws. This is the offset jaw. This one has swivels in the spring that you can see there. It's got some swivels here at the bottom. I don't know if you can see that, to prevent the chain from coiling. And then, importantly, the chain at the bottom has the sensor mounted, so to keep it more stable. And then we provided for a transitional provision for soft traps. And this basically means that we will allow landowners to use soft traps, that is traps that do not comply with the definition of a gin trap, for 3 years, and thereafter it must be used in accordance with these norms and standards. So if we're going to say a soft trap must have the following criteria or standards or specifications, is the right word, then that will have to be used. And that's where we want to cooperate with the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, because we've been discussing ways and means to get to a place where we have very tight requirements for the traps, and then link it maybe to a registration system and a marking system and so forth to ensure that we know what is being used and if it's fulfilled the requirements. And then very importantly, we said during this three-year period, we need to undertake research, and we have to put a proper system in place on how we will monitor and regulate the use of the soft traps. So there's a lot of ideas going around in terms of will we require specifications, and then it must be manufactured in terms of that specifications. People must be trained, all equipment must be marked, and then you permit and register that people can use it, and so forth. So in that period, a lot of work will have to be done. But keeping in mind, the public participation process, the date for comments is closed, and a lot of concerns have been submitted specifically on soft traps and the use of that. So it might be that at the end, it might not even be allowed. Then the use of dogs. We understand that the document is slightly confusing because we say it's only for flushing and retrieving, but then in the section we say when you use dogs for hunts. But just to be clear, in terms of the TOPS regulations, you're only allowed to use it for flushing and tracking, and in the beginning of the document we re-emphasize that you're only allowed to track and to flush. So we will make sure that is not that is clarified. And then we provide for a maximum use of 12 individuals, 6 that will actually participate in the flashing and tracking, and 6 that can be trained at the same time. And each dog pack must be registered, and all dogs must be microchipped. So those are the provisions in terms of the use of dogs. I know that comments have been submitted in terms of maybe using, what do you call it, a nuzzle or a muzzle, or what? Those things that you put over the, yeah. Then another, the last section in the document is about compensation. There was a lot of discussion around whether we, what we must include for compensation. And in the end, we basically just give criteria. So conservation authority, sand parks, or Limpopo, or Mpumalanga, they all have different requirements, so they may develop their own policy, but we specify that certain criteria must be included in this policy or strategy when they develop it. For example, the type of compensation must be specified in the strategy. You must have means to determine whether there was negligence on the part of the landowner or on part of the, for example, sandbox. It's a protected area where the animal comes from. The management methods implemented, whether the person has insurance and so forth. So the compensation part, we realized was more of the issue when we had a workshop with communities bordering sand parks, because they have a lot of problems. They're all small-scale farmers or subsistence farmers, and they have challenges in terms of the animals breaking out of kruger and either eating or trampling their maize and so forth, or lions killing their calves. So this was a big issue for the communities bordering protected areas. In terms of the community's response to the rest of the document, they were, as long as all of those are in place, but we need a compensation strategy. So that from the community's perspective, this was a very important part of the document. So just to wrap up, as I say, it's to provide for a national, coordinated, and uniform approach to the management of damage-causing animals. It provides the minimum requirements for the methods that require a permit in terms of traps. At this point in time, the use of soft traps will not be prohibited, but it must be used in terms of the requirements in the norms and standards, and this might change depending on the outcome of the public participation process. And very importantly, collaboration with DAF is required, because we need to share our resources and our thinking on how to make this work. Because through DAF, we can promote the non-lethal management options, and we can roll out a proper program for maybe the use of soft traps if it will remain. So we already had discussions just to see how we can maybe make it work, but that is very important for us to take it forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mrs. Carroll. Any comments from the Department of Agriculture? Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. At this stage, no comments. I can just maybe mention what we are looking at as well. One of the options is to look at Grootfontein as a predator research centre for the country. So that we can collate what's been done. We don't want to reinvent the wheel. We want to take note of what's been done, particularly the successful methods, and maybe just test a few things, because we're going to have very concrete answers if we're going to use these traps. What we're also looking at is a possibility of barcoding or micro-dot coding the traps. This is a system that will then link to the owner identification of that farm. We're looking at similar things now with animal identification, individual numbers. So everything will link together. It means that we'll be able to record more effectively, and that will help as well. And the other thing that we've been discussing as well is that if we do have something like this, it might be feasible then to have a permit issued annually instead of every time you have a problem, which is one of the issues that the President Marrington Forum in particular is concerned about, and that's the actual administration of the regulation. So if we can have a system, number one, where we can identify these traps, in other words, register them and have a micro-dot ID, we're looking at a similar system out of interest to mark the boats in marine fisheries, which would also link to a national register. So it's all starting to come together as far as that's concerned. I think that's what's important, very important that we work together. As you know, we are also in charge of the animal welfare legislation, and there's a welfare issue here, so we will link welfare issues to this so that if there are any additional requirements in terms of how you manage these animals once they are captured, etc., then we would put together something that would support these regulations. Thank you, Chair.
The background to what we're dealing here with also talks to a very urgent need that was expressed by the industry players. What's his name again? Petrus de Wet, I think. Who then made a statement that says the cost in relation to stock theft on what is being done by the predators far, far outweighs that of your stock theft. Stock theft typically would be talking of anything around 350 or so million per annum in terms of damages to the farmers. On this particular instance, you're talking of anything around, what, a billion rand per annum, something to that effect. Now, as a result of that, the outcry within the industry really prompts for an urgent intervention. I just thought, let me just also give that background so that we get a sense of the urgency of the issues that we're dealing with here and the damages that are being caused as we speak on these matters. Members, that's the briefing on the norms and standards. Mr. De Toya, I see your hand.
Thank you, Chairman. I have a few concerns. One is that on page 3 of this presentation we talk about substantial proof. Now that is something that is vague at this point, and who decides what would be substantive? There could be a lot of problems there. You know, the farmer may say that he's got proof, and the people having to issue the permit would say it's not. That gets me to the permit. What happens if the permit is refused, and who issues the permit? If it's a permit issued by the Department of Environmental Affairs, but it's an agricultural matter, it could be a conflict of interest. The other word mentioned that needs to define this specific individual, page 6. How are we going to say that this is the specific jackal or caracal that that needs to be exterminated or identified because it's a problem? Is this really practical? It was also mentioned that farmers should take note of the fact that land close to where predators are is a higher risk. Now that is a problem because I know these predators move. They move over big distances. There is no such place as a place close to predators or not close to predators, because they really move to where the prey are. They will move hundreds of kilometers. So it's really, that one does not make sense to me. Now there's also the use of the word barbaric and cruel methods. Not in this piece, but I know people talk about it. I think we all have a disgust in barbaric and cruel methods of any kind. But now this doesn't make sense for me how we reason about this problem. The way these predators kill the prey and it's by biting and tearing apart, some of them alive. We've seen it on TV. We know how it happened. We can see it from the, if I may say, the crime scene, how these entails are hanging out, how the sheep's being suffering for nights on end, half eaten. That is a barbaric and cruel method, but because it is an animal. It is the way of nature. Now, this is the way that these animals kill. But yet, we don't want to kill them in the same way. And then we say that the hyena is an apex predator that controls these numbers. How does a hyena kill these predators? By the same way, with his jaws. Okay? So, the question now is, if we restrict dog hunting, then we take that away. Is the dog not the next apex predator? The dog under supervision of the human, is that not the next apex predator that was removed? Because the way a hyena would kill a jackal, isn't that exactly the same way a dog will kill him? That's my question. So what is now barbaric, cruel methods? If the predator is allowed to kill a sheep in such a way, the hyena is allowed to kill this animal, this predator, in such a way, but the dog is not allowed to do it. That is my reasoning around this. These are questions I have to ask when we have the definitions about what is cruel, barbaric, and allowable. Thank you.
I hope you're not promoting an eye for an eye.
I would say a jaw for a jaw.
Any further comments or questions? Members? That was it.
Thank you, Chairperson. My fellow is a comment around the subsistence farmers. There is a huge outcry, but the presenters mentioned that there are some thoughts of compensating those who have suffered. But, you know, Chairperson, this I think should be seen to be applied all over the country, because, you know, in some parts of KwaZulu-Natal where we have these project areas, people around there suffer a lot due to these predators, more especially the hyenas and the leopards. Mind you, these days a leopard is one of the predator species that cannot be killed anyhow. But there is no proper method of stopping them from moving from the protected areas into the rural areas where you could find that they destroy a lot of livestock. These days, Chairperson, I'm not sure what type of an animal that is. You know, I think it was two years back we had instances where people in around Opati Game Reserve, where people were found dead, assumed to be killed by certain animals that have moved from the protected areas into the residential areas of the rural communities. I think 2 weeks back, in and around Upongolo, we had the same experience. We have three people that have been killed by unknown animals, which have moved out of the protected areas into the communal areas. So the concern and the comment is around that. I think more needs to be looked into in order to see to it that the rural people as well are looked after. Not that they should be penalized for having say hunted and killed an animal that has moved out of the protected area into a residential area. Because, you know, if one has to say, has to inform the authorities, it takes them a long time to move to that area not to assist the people. I think a year or two back, there was a hippo right inside the crawl of the cow in one of the homesteads. But the authorities couldn't move in order to assist those people. On the third day, when the hippo was still there, then the people killed it. And they were threatened by being arrested and charged for having killed the animals. So I think there needs to be a balance between the protection of wildlife as well as the lives of the innocent people. Thank you, Chair.
Mama, you listen, sir?
Thank you. Firstly, I just want to apologize for arriving late. I was caught in traffic. Chairperson, even though we have discussed this, because it's before us, we shall just continue discussing it. And on page 2, Chairperson, where it says the processes of development, we would like maybe to see where they say approved for publication for comment by WGI, MINTED, and MINMED, and we would like to see the comment. What are they commenting? And this jackals and baboons and some of the wild animals, it's the cry in every province. I think you know we do have this thing, and many communities they lost their livestock in the hands of this animal. And really, if the minister was here, maybe. Or department, they should guide us. How far are they? And how far are they? The national and the provincial provinces concerning maybe or a policy or whatever. That's why I'm saying we need to see the comments. And because in our last minute meeting, I still remember. Honorable Duterte was even suggesting maybe the killing of this Jacob. And I can also say maybe they must be limited, especially jackals and baboons. You know, these big predators like lions and the hippos, sometimes they are kept in camps. It's just a mistake. Sometimes you find that one of those, they are out and they're threatening the lives of our people out there. But all in all, really, this black jackals and caracal and baboons, they need to be controlled in number, if need be, because jackals, we don't eat. There is no meat for jackals. Is there? There is any meat for jackals? No. I never heard that there are people or a tribe who are eating jackals in South Africa. They are. Well, you know, I think there must be limitation to limit them, either by killing or do what, poisoning. But these things they must be limited. Because it really is a thorn in all provinces. Thank you, Chief President.
Bishop?
Thank you so much, Comrade Chief President. A little bit late. The problem it was the traffic. You know, Comrade Chief President, I just want to make a follow up point raised from. I'm a rural man from Limpopo province. You know, I think 1 or 2 years they were talking about lions from Kruger National Park through to fence and villages there in rural area where the lions was killing the livestock of poor people. Now, I just find out because I agree, we mustn't kill the animals, I agree. But my question is that they kill the people, poor people are using those livestock at home to get the food. And the lions kill those animals. I just found out that the department refund those people their livestock to also, you know, I just found out because those things that were happening, I think it's 1 or 2 years. Maybe you know better than myself. And I just find out the department do something to refund those people and so on. Thanks very much.
Dr. Bosman?
Yes, thank you. I think most of it has been said, but I would like to maybe just start and add a few things. First of all, I think we must recommend the departments of environmental affairs as well as agriculture and the other role players to put up a management process and a framework within which we can deal with the problem, because as you well know, and I think we've heard in the previous presentations as well, that because of the biodiversity imbalance that was created through various situations, one knocks effect has a knock-on effect on the other. And at the moment, the farming sector, obviously, and it was highlighted again here this morning by the other members, are facing serious losses as far as that's concerned. I think, especially in the small stock industry, and I think we know that vast parts of our country is really only conducive to cattle farming, and we will have to look at it and manage it in such a way that they can keep on farming in a profitable way. The effect of the situation probably is bigger than just what we are talking here in this morning. I believe obviously that the management of this causing animals or the lack of management was the cause of the small stock industry having losses, tremendous losses. And I think the figures that was quoted is that the wool crop has been halved in South Africa over the last 10 years, which is a serious problem. And I think it we must look at it from that way as well. I think economically we are suffering. It is job creation that is lost and so on. So what my argument around it is here, let us look at the problem and come up with solutions and try and solve the problems as it is. We obviously also know that because of conservation areas, which is, our colleague here from the Limpopo province has highlighted it, huge areas of farming areas has been conversed to conservation areas, and people are more and more farming with wild animals than rather than try to make a living from domestic animals, and that as a result that the population of these causing animals has increased, and I think that is why also we are trying to get a national approach on it, and I think that is from my side I really would say a thank you word of to our people that are trying to come up with the solutions. Coming up with the solutions, I don't want to go into the problem quite deeply, because I think we will see from the summaries of the presentations that were made from various stakeholders that there are different views on the issues. And trying to get the middle ground and satisfy everybody is obviously going to be very difficult, and not all the people will be satisfied with the outcomes in the end. But we will have to try and get a management tool in place that can control the problem, that can manage it, and that can make it possible for the farming community to keep on. And at the end, in the end, obviously, food security is at stake, and we cannot say that if we are not producing, say, for instance, red meat sufficiently in South Africa, we can import it, because that is not the way any country should go. We should be self-sufficient in all the commodities that we deal with. So from my side, I think what we really take very good notice of the presentation, and I think a lot of work has gone into it, and I think a lot of the issues that have been addressed, solutions have come to the fore. And I think I'm looking forward to see what the result of the summary of the inputs were also going to, and what changes are going to be made. Because I think in the end, that is the focus where we will have to come in, to say, listen, this is in the interest of the farming community, this is in the interest of biodiversity, and what, so that we can strike a balance. At the moment, we can take notice of the work that has been done, but I think the crux of the matter is, in the end, we will have to see what the final result of the outcome of this process is. Thank you, sir.
Mrs.
Carter.
Thank you, Chief. If I just go to page 6, we'll be talking about the incentives for farmers that will be using non-lethal methods. My concern there is all about implementation. How are we going to implement it? How are we going to control it? Then we go and we... Another question is, when animals are captured, are we going to look at microchipping them? If we're going to relocate them? You know, is that also part of a plan at this stage or not? Sorry, Chair. Then on compensation, just from Bishop Tolo now as well saying that, you know, the losses that takes place. Now, my concern is we're talking here from the presentation we had in late last year, was in November, that I think we were talking about, unfortunately I haven't got the documents here, but it was around about 1.4, 1.6 billion rand. Yeah, per annum. Now, if we're looking at compensation, how are we going to compensate? How are we going to budget? Is it going to be part of the next budget? You know, and implementation is going to be one of the major problems. So what if we got there? And as Dr. Bosman was also saying, I mean, we have to be realistic. This is really impacting on food security in this country. And that is what we need to look at. Now, the question is, who is going to really run with it? Is it going to be the Department of Environmental Affairs, or is it going to be the Department of Agriculture? And I think that all, because jointly you're going to find, my feeling is that jointly you're going to have a problem where this responsibility will be with this department, that responsibility with that department, and we're not going to be able to implement. That's I'm covered. Thanks. Thank you, Chair.
Let's take the first round, Mr. Dutoy, and then we come back on the second round.
Thank you, Chair. I hope I noted all the questions. If I haven't, then if we can just go again. In terms of substantial proof, as I mentioned, the definition for damage-causing animals was included in the top regulations that was promulgated in 2007. And even in that development process, the definition was very complex and difficult because, as you will see now, the focus is on a damage-causing animal can only be considered a damage-causing animal once losses or have occurred. So it doesn't provide for the preventative angle that a lot of the farmers are calling for. So in terms of the definition, we use the one in the regulations because in terms of legislation, you cannot change your definition from one document to another if they all talk to each other. So the TOPS regulations, we are busy with amendments, and in that process, we will relook the definition of damage-causing animals and then align the norms and standards with that. But the feeling at that point in time is there must be substantial proof that losses has occurred, because a lot of times... you know, I don't want to say anything against farmers, but sometimes the management practices and the husbandry on the farms are not what it should be, and animals are killed, but it's not necessarily the predators that are killing the animals, and so forth. So there's different dynamics, and from a conservation perspective, we felt that there must be some form of proof that losses have occurred, and those losses are due to predators. If you can follow that train of thought, but what must also be kept in mind is that definition relates to threatened or protected species, so it doesn't really relate to include the complexities around black-back jackal and caracal, because it's not listed in terms of the TOPS regulations. So taking into consideration, we were dealing with threatened or protected species. You do not want a leopard to just be regarded as a damage-causing animal. You wanted to have a system in place where there must be proof that losses were caused by leopard, not by something else, so that you take out the problem and not something that's not causing the problem. So everything is extremely complex in that sense, and that's why the substantial proof was required. And then it's linked to a process where the provincial conservation authorities must do inspections, go to the site and get all the information, and that is also elaborated on in the document. So they must actually go to the farm where the losses have occurred and do an inspection to see what the losses were, whether there's any signs of a predator being involved, and so forth. If you are trained and you're knowledgeable about the aspect, you will be able to do that kind of inspection. And then, as I said, in terms of the reporting, you will propose suitable measures to be implemented. So that will either be, you ask who issues the permit, it's the provincial conservation authorities that will issue the permit. And that's based on the inspection and the report then. And it will only be refused if there is no clear indication that a predator has caused the damage and if there's another solution that can be found. In terms of that, we would like to promote management interventions as well. We need the farmer to take responsibility to a further degree for their livestock. I know it's difficult in areas like Northern Cape where the camps are huge and livestock is roaming very far, but we need them to take more proactive measures in terms of the livestock guarding animals or shepherding and so forth to address that. Whether it's feasible, we do not know, and we need that engagement to come to those solutions. Then, yes, there might be conflict in terms of the interest, a farmer needing a permit and needs immediate action. But I think from conservation's perspective, we also recognize that, yes, there can be losses due to predators, leopard, jackal, and so forth. And I think a lot of provinces have dealt with it and is currently dealing with blackback, jackal, and caragal by including them in a list of problem animals. They call it problem animals, not damage-causing animals. Problem animals that can be hunted on farms at the moment. So if it's listed in terms of that, the farmer can take action to address his problem. And that will remain until we now say you cannot do it. So that system is in place. And we're not touching on that system currently in terms of these norms and standards because blackback, jackal, and caracal is not listed in terms of TOPS. And if they are included, we need to consider the implications thereof. But at the moment, they are handled in terms of the provincial legislation. Then in terms of the specific individual, I think I mentioned we want trained people to use the different methods, and the provincial conservation authorities also have sections, that specific sections that deal with problem animals and damage-causing animals, and those individuals are trained to be able to identify where a specific individual has caused damage. Jackal is problematic because they have a different, social structure and so forth. So I agree that might be difficult, but that is one of the issues that we then need to address. The farmers close to natural areas and the increase in risk, I don't know how to respond to that, because your risk is higher. If you live next to Sasol or Eskom, you will have problems with your sinuses and so forth. It is a reality. We are aware of the reality, and we would like to find solutions to that. I think a lot of issues in terms of protected areas we can address, the bigger animals we can address through proper fencing and so forth, but that's in an area that if it's not sufficiently addressed, we need to look at options. But the risk will be higher, and you will not be able to get rid of those predators because they will retract back into the park and they will just come out again if you're going to start hunting them. They will just adapt and respond accordingly. Barbaric and cruel, I'm not going to get into that. if you don't mind, maybe agriculture would like to get into that. But I think I emphasized enough in terms of the traps that we feel we need to use. It's not only to address the welfare aspect, but it's also to address the concern that we have that the methods must be more discriminate. We don't want indiscriminate ways of dealing with it. We need to take out the problem, otherwise we don't solve the problem for either us or for the farmers. So we don't want indiscriminate use of indiscriminate methods. We want it to be specific and species specific. The compensation issue, I think it was a comment made, and that comment is definitely noted. We are aware of the issue. What we're trying to do in certain areas, there's agreement between the management authority of the protected area and then the provincial authority in that area to cooperate in terms of giving, especially in the communal areas, assistance. And what we discussed with the community that in the workshop that we had is that maybe if we look at the norms and standards, we say that only people that are trained can do certain activities with permits. So we thought of a system where they'll have associations in the communities that someone is selected from that community to be trained properly, and that person has direct contact to the authority to be able to deal with situations. So the community has some nice ideas on how we can maybe assist them in terms of that. So you have someone in the community that can respond and that has contact with the provincial conservation authority to ensure more timely response to issues. Okay. In the process of development, I thought the question was that you would like to see the comments made during the process, for example, Working Group 1, MINSEC, and MINMEC. And there I can only say that the initial submission to Working Group 1 in 2009, it was referred back to give more clarity in terms of research needed, the specifications for gin traps, the use of dogs, and so forth. So there was a number of issues that were highlighted at Working Group 1 that had to be readdressed, and then it was resubmitted. But MINSEC and MINMEC approved it without making any amendments at that point in time, if I recall correctly. I don't have the document with me. The issue in Limpopo, it is in Limpopo that we had the community workshop, Limpopo and Mpumalanga, and I think that is noted. The community actually had very good ideas in terms of should a compensation strategy be developed, what it should entail in terms of an independent valuator coming to assess the damage, and not only accepting maybe financial compensation but also replacement of stock and so forth. So the community themselves had very good ideas of how we can maybe elaborate on the compensation strategy. But what I need to point out is that it's not a requirement, and because of the legal standing of game in terms of common law, which is res nullius, belonging to no one, it's difficult to prescribe the compensation strategy because legally it's a complex matter. And that's why we didn't say you must have one. You may have one, and then you must take into consideration certain issues. In terms of you mentioned that we need a management process and framework. I can only say we agree, but we need a balance, and we need to discuss how we will reach that balance, because in terms of our mandate, we are concerned about certain issues, but I do think we will get solutions, and I think I referred to the problem animals in terms of the provincial ordinances where a farmer has the ability to take action against blackback jackal and caracal at this point in time. Where am I? Okay. Your question. I just didn't get page 6. You asked something about implementation and control, and my page 6 seems to differ from yours, so if I can just get that issue. But in terms of, I'll just continue in the meantime, in terms of translocation, we brought in the issue that you must consult adjacent landowners and record keeping. And the idea is if you're going to relocate an animal, that the microchipping is not a bad idea, but it will probably be done that you microchip and then you keep records to see whether that animal comes back. Because, for example, leopards will return to the area, their territory where they were. So in that way we can track whether this is the same animal coming back into the area and then take appropriate action to address that. So I like the microchipping idea in terms of the translocation. What was the incentive? Okay. The incentives issue is not elaborated on in the document. I think just because we didn't have any, there were some ideas, for example, marketing mechanisms for farmers that farm and tolerate predators. So they have a policy where they implement other management interventions other than lethal control. And in that way, for those farmers then to promote those farmers and their produce. So that was the idea around that, but it wasn't, we didn't have sufficient information. Maybe through the public participation process we'll get some more ideas on how we can promote that. But the incentives is basically to promote the use of management interventions and non-lethal methods that will obviously address both our concerns. The compensation, yes, the funding, one of the first criteria is in the norms and standards for the compensation strategy is where will, how will funding be secured? And that is the challenge for all the provinces because there's just no funds and who will get what proportion and so forth and what is considered losses in the commercial sector versus the small-scale farmer versus the subsistence farmer. For the subsistence farmer, one, the loss of one animal is a loss that should be compensated, while some of the commercial farmers might carry a loss of I don't know, 10. So it's very difficult, the whole compensation thing, and once again, that's why we didn't specify that it must be developed. In terms of running the implementation and the rollout, we would like to work in close collaboration with agriculture because there's obviously a lot of overlapping issues and issues from their side that also needs to be considered. But DIA, I think, will continue to take the lead. It's only in areas where, for example, you want to develop a code of conduct or standards for trainers and so forth, that then we will request DAF to ensure that that is done in terms of their legal mandate. But in terms of the norms and standards, the department will continue to take the lead, but we would like to work closely with them because we don't see the rollout being successful if they're not on board in terms of lots of issues, the soft traps, the use of that, the regulation of that, the registering, promoting non-lethal management methods and so forth. I hope I covered all of it.
Welcome, Ms. Abram.
Sorry for being late, Chairperson. I had a taxi called an accident on the highway and we were all blocked up.
And Mama Parisa. Welcome. You had your hand up, Mr. Abram.
Yes.
And then I see there are follow-up questions from Ms. Carter and Mr. Dutoy and Bishop Tola. That was Mama Phyllis Masson.
Thank you, Chairperson. it's very difficult to
Mr. Abram, Mrs. Carter, Mr. Dutoy, Bishop Tola, Mama Phyllis Masson.
No, I apologize for being late, for good reason. Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, you know, the problem is that it's like, you know, we're fiddling whilst Rome is burning. Just this morning in the plane, I was reading about some new farmers in an area called, I think Ms. Paliso will know the area better than me. Van Rijksvlei and Brandvlei are complaining about how predators have decimated their profits. Now, Chairperson, you see, one can come with all these rules and regulations and what have you. The law says, Chairperson, that nobody has the right to lynch me. But the law cannot absolutely prevent me from being lynched. Likewise, Chairperson, all these rules and regulations and things can only work if they are beneficial to all sides. Now, those predators, they don't read these rules and regulations yet. It's a human being that must do all these things. And accept it, Chairperson, that the farmer is already overburdened with numerous regulations. You know, you take, for example, is a Roycutter Caracal, I think so, eh? You take the Roy Cut, Chairperson, if that gets into your flock, you've had it. They even go as far as, on farms you have people, especially poor people, who have a couple of chickens to lay a couple of eggs and a little bit of protein and things. They decimate all their stock. Poor people, Chairperson, poor farm workers. Now, Chairperson, my problem is that all the time we are placing an increasing burden on those people whom we should be protecting, because they are the ones that are helping to ensure food security. And that, to my mind, is a major problem. Other problem, Chairperson, is that these things take an inordinately long time to finalize and put into practice. In the meantime, Chairperson, there are people that are forced out of business. If you take, for example, it's small stock like goats and sheep that are affected. But there are also, two-legged predators these days, Chairperson. And they don't steal one or two lorry loads. It's putting many of the people out of business. You just cannot survive. What I'm asking for, Chair, is that we've got to ask ourselves a few questions. We're not talking here of large predators like leopards, which are not that large in number to effect a major impact. Although they do wherever they roam, they do cause damage. But you take now the fact that there's been so many regulations, and jackal, for example, they breed like no man's business, Chairperson. And I think nobody can actually do a census on jackals. But if you look at the extent of the damage that's being caused, you can see that they are working overtime, Jefferson. They do their job. Can't stop them. No regulation will stop them, Jefferson. And I want to just warn, Chair, that if we are going to make regulations which are very tedious, my problem always is that the law must be simple. Regulations must be simple. They must be implementable. And unfortunately, we'll be taken up in this quagmire of all the rules and regulations. You didn't comply with this and you didn't comply with that. You should have done this and you should have done that. I made a note here as the good lady was responding to some of the earlier questions. It basically boils down to this, Chair. The farmer must lose first. And then we'll talk. Then we'll decide whether he needs a permit to do away with certain predators or not. Chairperson, I don't know. You know, if we don't streamline our processes in such a way that on the one hand it is encouraging to the farmer to carry on producing, and on the other hand we also look at the environmental issues, but the problem, Chairperson, is that most of the environmentalists are not people who are at the receiving end. They are normally people who live in towns and cities, normally. Maybe environmentalists here and there in the rural areas. But I want to tell this meeting, Chairperson, that a farmer is a being that tries to live in harmony with the environment. And the farmer has to live in harmony with the environment, otherwise the environment will be depleted. And what we have today in our rural areas is as a result of the farmer living in harmony. So, Chairperson, I've merely made comments. But it takes inordinately long to come to some other arrangement. In the meantime, the farmer is busy losing out, and we are going to pay the price for food security. And we need to be very wary of what this kind of impact could be in our country and what it could lead up to. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Dutoy?
Thank you, Chairperson.
Sorry, Mrs. Carter. Sorry, Mrs. Carter and Mr. Dutoy.
Chair, thank you. It's very difficult to speak after Mr. Abram, so I'm covered.
Thank you. Okay. You also covered?
Yeah, Chairperson, it's very difficult to support legislation in part or in whole if it's unclear or it's unspecified or you don't know what the results will be or if you don't know what the outcome will be or what the purpose of it is. Let me explain. We talk about specific individual, but from Mrs. Carroll's answer, it actually should be specific species. Because it's not an individual animal, it is the, in this case, as you answered, it's the jackal and the caracal that's causing the problem in a specific area, and we don't want to blanket kill all the other smaller jackals, that's how I understand. So, but if it's not so, if it's not a specific species in that area, and if it's an individual, I really have a problem with this law, this legislation, because how are you going to prove it's a specific jackal? That's just impossible, cannot. Okay, I don't blame you because you had a lot of questions, but if the permit is refused, it does say on what grounds, how long does this, it will take, how long will it take to get this permit? Because as a member, Honorable Member Salam Abram said, is while these flocks are being decimated in the hundreds in a single night, it can happen, then you're waiting for this permit to be issued. That brings me to the next one, and that is these inspections that must go out to a farm. Do we have enough people? I don't think we have. Do we have enough resources, petrol, diesel? Do we have enough time? You're looking at the forensic investigation on each farm. My question is, are we going to leave the carcasses to rot in the sun for 2 or 3 or 4 days until the guy arrives? What do you do? I mean, you must fly him in the helicopter and say, look, last night I had a problem. Fly him in and check it out. We don't have the resources for that. You can't leave these animals rotting in the sun. I mean, we will have an explosion of, what is this, assholes? It's called vultures. Yes. I mean, you know, so it's just impractical. And I don't know how we're going to deal with this if we don't. How can we put legislation on paper if we cannot answer these questions? The other one is the compensation which Desiree touched on. I also thought about that. The point is, how do you compensate a guy? He's lost 100 sheep out of his 1,000. Okay, you pay him, all right? Or you replace it, but you replace it again and again because you're just setting the table, Christmas table every night, every time you pay, every time you replace the animal for the jackal, having Christmas dinners every day. Now, if you pay the guy out, and next month he's got 100 less and you pay him, and next month, how many months? After 10 months he's got nothing left. Then how much do you pay him then? Because he's got no more losses because everything has been wiped out. How do you compensate him now? Are you going to say, okay guys, you had 1,000 sheep, they've all been eaten by jackal, but you would have had 1,000 sheep for the rest of your life, we're going to pay you out every year 1,000 sheep for the rest of your life. This is the logic in this law that I don't understand, this legislation that I don't understand. Okay, now, my questions are this, my real nitty gritty thing about this is, how did the predators get to be so numerous? I mean, There were times in the past, I remember from my granddaddy's days that, you know, they went out on hunts and, you know, it was this and that, and they've always just talk about jackal and caracal. It's always been there. But how did it happen that this explosion in predators the last decade or so, how did this happen? That's my question. Now, if the previous to the current legislation or methods did not work, okay, it did not work. I want to know, is it because maybe one or two methods were not used, like maybe dogs, I don't know, just asking, or is it something else? And then, the crux of the matter is, Chairperson, how will the new draft legislation alleviate this problem? If we had this explosion of predators up to now, then if this new draft legislation is going to be alleviating this problem, then I think the farmers would all have been shouting hallelujah, hallelujah, but they're not. So it means that this draft legislation will not alleviate the problem. I don't blame them to say that, because the things that I mentioned before, it's murky waters. There's nothing clear in this legislation about a lot of things. And then I'm asking the questions, are we shying away from the killing methods? That's what I'm saying. Because we talk about this and we have euphemisms here, we talk about management, we talk about this and that, but nobody tells us here, how are we going to get rid of these animals that is in excess? Okay, we want conservation, and my colleague Dr. Bosman used a nice word, I actually wrote it down here, the biodiversity imbalance that has been created. We don't want to eradicate biodiversity, but the imbalance in it has been created. How are we going to redress this with this new legislation? I cannot see it. So, Chairperson, I have my questions there, I think, is very difficult to answer. I don't know if it can be answered today, but these are mulling in my head, and we need to address this. But plus at this point, from what I see and what I hear, is that this draft legislation needs a lot of work. And in the meantime, what are we going to do in the meantime? How are we going to save the flocks of South Africa? Because up to now, nothing has worked. Thank you.
Bishop Tuller.
Thank you very much, Comrade Chairperson. Comrade Chairperson, I'm going to talk about livestock, but if I'm out, Chairperson, you'll stop me. You know, the date of apartheid in the rural area, you know, always I'll talk about rural area because I grew there. And there was some other group with a khaki uniform. And those group were, say, Marenjana, but they were under agriculture, if I'm not mistaken, but somebody can correct me. Those people, they were looking in a rural area, looking livestock. If you are not looking after your livestock, this thing in Afrikaans called bosleys, by those animals, and if you don't look after the dogs and all those things, they will charge you. And if you drive on the road, it was not easy to get the cattle sleeping in the street. And so poor people in the rural area, they're trying to make a farming, small farming. But you'll find the cattle that are there, they're just damaging. And from 1994 till now, no one looking after those problems in rural area, no one. If they're damaging you are a small farmer, you don't know what you must do. And when you drive, people who don't even know that the place, you get the cattle, they're on the tree, on the tar road, they're sleeping. Human beings die, and also the animal they get injured and all those things. Now, I just find out, Comrade Chairperson, why is like this now? You know, you don't even know who's the right person, because you ask him or her about this kind of problem. Because these things are very important, but if you look nowadays, it's terrible. And you'll find donkey injury, the donkey. You know, if you look, you don't even want to look. And they are using that donkey, and nobody can say, you made a mistake, don't do that. And you look, the government just keep quiet. You don't know, we don't know what we must do. Because the time of apartheid it was not good. But in administration, it was good. Because they were looking, it was against some human being. But at the same time, it was looking, at the same time, an animal also to get a better life. I don't know who is the right person, who is responsible. My question is that, where is those people? They were looking after the animal stock life. Where is those people? In town here, there's a SPCA. If, you know, sometime when I'm driving in Western Cape, you know, you get one donkey, you know, they take the kumbi on that small levers. You know, you can see, you feel painful. And then I think that kind of thing, maybe we must look into. I don't know who is the right person now who can look this thing I'm talking about. And I just found out, where is those people? And really, they were going up and down, they're looking. If the donkey is injured, you don't look after that donkey, they charge you. If you're not looking about your cattle, your own cattle, so-called bosslets, then they charge you. But these days, nothing. I just found out on the department why.
Mama, you listen, son?
Chairperson, much has been said, and but while we are seated in boardrooms like this, discussing the legislation, the management of damage causing animals, our people outside, the farmers, communities, they are suffering. And here they are saying use of dogs. Each dog pack must be registered and microchipped. For example, in the rural there, in the bushes, if many jackals can just come out and attack the livestock of the community, and their dogs will try to catch the jackals, and they are not a microchipped, and then that is wrong. Sometimes I don't know why we take so long, you know, to come up with measures to stop other things. According to me, it's like sometimes we have a law, but if that law is vice versa, we don't know what to say anymore. For example, in our country, in South Africa, we have this law which says, if I can just now say, you, Margaret Etwala, you are a witch. You are a witch. She can go to the police station and I can be arrested. But the law is quiet when Margaret herself can stand here and say, you know what? I'm a witch. I've destroyed many, many people here. The law is quiet. It doesn't say Margaret will be arrested because she confessed that she's a witch. That's why I'm saying sometimes our laws, we should look at them. You look at the soft trap there. Device must be inspected and approved, minimum requirements, the size, the type, the screw, the chain must so be so like this, like this. And in our communities there in the rural areas, you know, they don't know about these things. Uri, what they must do when they see the animals, this predators, they just do whatever. They kill it, they do it, they chase them with their dogs, or their dogs kill them, they don't care, as long as they are protecting their stocks. And I'm trying to think that, but how long are we going to sit here trying to come out with a legislation to cap these predators? And it will take, you know, you'll see. Maybe this time can be even finished before we can come out with a proper legislation to control these things. As I have already said, these things, there are many. Jackals, we don't eat jackals. There are many. They can be reduced. Any means, they can be reduced. And hyenas, they can be reduced. Any animal which is danger, so dangerous to people's crops, people's livestock, you know, that animal is not needed. except those who are which are kept in the camps. But what animal would jackal? Jackals and hyenas, they're just roaming on mountains, baboons everywhere, and they are not controlled. And there are so many, now they are increasing, because actually they are producing. They are increasing, there are so many. And we don't have a legislation or a how could we deal with these things. Well, as you know, they are dinamukula to us. We don't need them so much. Chairperson, thank you.
Very interesting session indeed. You know, this session, it really, you know, covers a whole range of spectrum of issues. You know, on one hand, you know, we hear that apartheid administration was good. And I saw Mr. Tutoi smiling all the way. You also going to hear people saying, you know, predators don't read these norms and standards. Now, which begs the question, of course, related to what the other members are saying here, that talks to the poor farmers out there are suffering as we speak, whilst we are seated in these boardrooms, engaging in discussion for long, and these norms and standards having been on the table for a long time. Now, question that really begs here is, whom are these norms and standards meant for? Mm. Are these meant for your commercial farmers who have the means and who are going to be able to manage and regulate as requested, or rather going to be stipulated? And what about those other subsistence farmers who really even struggle to make ends meet? Now you're really adding a lot of burden on them in terms of administration, in terms of protection of their stock and so on. Now, very interesting session indeed, because the question here really begs again also the implementability of these norms and standards. Granted, these are norms and standards flowing out of your National Environment Management Biodiversity Act of 2004, which stipulates that, among others, the minister may issue norms and standards for the achievement of the objects of the act itself, which is what we are doing, within the environment and water affairs. Now, the issue at hand here has anything and everything to do with food security, as to how best to protect and promote food security. We hear a number of things being said about to an extent in which we import red meat, for argument's sake, even white meat also, and other commodities. Now, the extent in which we import all of those and the risk factors that are associated with farming itself are the kind of issues that we're dealing with here, to a point where we really need to say practically, how do we mitigate against such risks? Whether the norms and standards are enough for us to be able to say these are mitigating factors enough to promote and protect food security. I think those are the kind of issues that we are really dealing with. Now I hear you when you refer to Department of Agriculture and Fisheries. It must only come in at a time wherein there is enforcement of these norms and standards. Now, the responsibility and the main object of that department is about promotion of food security in our country. Now, I'm not sure as to how you then get to speak to that, understandably so, that yours is about protection of biodiversity. And yet the mandate of the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries speaks broadly to a need to protect and promote food security. Now these are the kinds of issues that we really have to deal with as we move forward on this particular issue. Mama Palisa?
I'm covered, can you cover?
You're fine.
Yes, you're
You cannot speak, sir, sorry. Now, we are certainly going to have a hearing on these matters. So that's where you can come in. But for now, this is a briefing from the department. That's how it works. Thank you. You want to respond, Mrs. Kara?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chair. I don't know if I must start with your issues or with the first issues. The comments is noted from the community members. In terms of the questions about the explosion of the numbers and previous legislation, I think in part the existing legislation is in part to blame for the existing explosion, because in terms of provincial legislation you can hunt jackal and caracal and you can remove them, you can kill them, you can whatever them. And I think that has a direct effect in terms of the explosion, because it's a natural response of the predator to his situation. If you persecute him, he will breed earlier, he will have more pups in his litters, he will have more frequent litters, it's a direct response of the existing legislation, which is why we need to change something. And what I'm beginning to realize is maybe this norms and standards is not where that change is going to happen, because as I mentioned, this is relating to threatened or protected species, which I'm sure you can understand. We need to have stricter measures to address when you remove a leopard, because we would like more consideration before you remove. Not that I say they're not all equal, you know, in terms of animal issues and so forth. But the norms and standards and the permits required in terms of this document refers to those species that are listed as threatened and protected. And I think you can all agree that, yes, you know, if we consider something as threatened or protected, we must be more considerate in terms of how we're addressing it. But jackal and caracal is not listed there, and they are regulated in terms of provincial legislation. And I think those practices has caused this explosion. That linked to the more areas being converted to game farms, so more prey available, more regular movement, where previously there were larger livestock areas and people tend to move them out. They sort of kept out to a degree. But now you have game farms interspersed with the livestock farms. So yes, they roam where they haven't roamed, but it's also the act of persecution or shooting out that is contributing. So from an environmental perspective, it doesn't work, because the ecological processes and systems is disrupted. And obviously for the livestock farmers, it's not working. And I think from outside, we acknowledge that there is real concerns, but at the moment, we're not prohibiting the action that the farmer can take in terms of jackal and caracal. And it's not in terms of this document, we're not restricting that at the moment. It's still regulated in terms of provincial requirements. And then I can just say, I don't know if I'm addressing all your questions. We are not shying away from killing. If an animal is a problem animal or a damage-causing animal, we're not saying you're not allowed to kill it. You're allowed to kill it. What we want to do, and I think certain principles are set down in the document, which is guiding principles that are now, the document's applicable to TOPS, but it's principles we would like to implement across the board. And we would like farmers to take, where possible, more responsibility for management of livestock. I know it's difficult, and I know it's, you know, jackal-proof fencing is not jackal-proof and so forth. but, I mean, we've been provided with information where farmers will go to a camp once in a month, once in 2 months, and there's no shepherding, there's no You know, it's also no action taken. So it must be, we must find solutions on both sides. As environmental affairs, we're not going to solve your problem today because we're in this meeting briefing and our document is not the document that I think that you are looking for. But I do think that from a biodiversity perspective, we will try and do our job, but maybe there's also a need for promoting better management practice. And I've been speaking to some farmers, and a lot of them don't make use of lethal methods. They have all kinds of other measures in place, and it is working. So maybe making that available, trying to get, I know there's a lot of manuals in terms of managing your stock to prevent losses and so forth. There are manuals, but maybe we must have a better sharing of information on what is working, what's not working, and when do you take the action to take to kill the animal to remove it. So in terms of how long, I hope to be finished with this document by the end of the year, but it's obviously in terms of the species of concern at the moment, a year. No, definitely not end of March. So we received more than 1,000 comments and about 2,500 petitions that we are still considering, so definitely not end of March. The end of the calendar year, yes, we will have a document. So in terms of who the document is for, it's for everyone. It's not only for commercial farmers, and that's why we had some sessions with the community members, and I do believe that we need to be more actively involved with the communities. They had a good laugh when they heard about the cell phone collars, and they thought it was a very innovative idea, but not very practical for them. But the idea is that it must be implemented across the board in terms of that. Then yes, food security is the issue. And I know it's the mandate of agriculture to promote food security, and I'm not questioning that, but because of the practices at the moment that's not working, it's threatening food security. So we need to find a solution for this. Actively killing them, you know, damage-causing animals is not working, and that has an impact, you know. So we need to find a solution, but what I think the department must also keep in mind is that they're also responsible for the Animal Protection Act, and they will also be approached to respond to barbaric and whatever practices. So in itself, the department has this dual responsibility that might be difficult to address this issue. The implementability, yet resources are limited. But we hope to pool resources in terms of involving agriculture as far as possible, not only in the enforcement, but also in the further development in terms of getting ideas for the how we can implement the soft traps issues and so forth. Yes, and in terms of the current norms and standards, we provide for trained persons to also assist in terms of, that can use certain of the methods. And that trained person doesn't have to be official of the organ of state, and in that sense you can also involve farming communities and so forth to be part of that. The carcasses. Oh yeah, that is actually something that's been that came up also in the TOPS amendment issues, and that we need to specify a response time in the legislation. How fast the response, how fast the person must respond. If there was a threat, then it's a different thing. But when a loss has occurred, then you know, if something was seen in the vicinity, you know, versus when losses have occurred, that we have a specific time frame within which the provincial conservation authorities must respond. That's not specified at the moment. So I take that comment. Thank you. I hope I addressed everything, Chair.
You want to make additions? Just a few comments. From a historical point of view as well, if you think of the whole issue of jackal-proof fencings, if you're going back to the 1930s and there onward, it worked because it was a network of fences. What happened in between then is that you had people converting to other types of farming, so there's no longer a network of fences. They weren't maintained,
things like that. So I think maybe this is something that agriculture should look at, is the whole issue of fencing, because it did work. What has happened in between now is that you've got an imbalance, and it's not possible to control that imbalance just with fencing. So we have to somehow get the balance back to what it should be. If it needs getting a lot of jackals, then that should be done. It's part of the thing. But I think once we've got these things in place, then we should look at the whole issue of fencing again as part of jackal control and or predator control. And that's where the department would naturally come in with the Fencing Act and all that. So it is something that we need to look at. I can just add that reference was made to the old days. The people in khaki clothes were most probably stock inspectors. Now, that was a very good system. Maybe again we need to get back to that, because it's useful to have a stock inspector, Maripan, to at least be on track and that. And that gets back to your primary animal health care, which is something that the department is looking at, and I'm sure my Deputy Director General, Dr. Mogajani, will be able to answer these type of questions. But I think it's very important to get back to a system like that, because once these things are in place, you have better administration as well, which is not the case at the moment. We have a shortage of stock inspectors and that. I can also add that hopefully this year we've got it on the program, the pounds will go through. And if that happens, then you'll have a system in place where it can be devolved to provinces so that we have a uniform system for the impounding of animals, which would stop a lot of the problems with donkeys, etc., you know, on the roads and that. Another thing that we looked at as well, if you think of how the campfire system in Zimbabwe evolved, it was actually for the management of problem animals. In other words, instead of a community getting compensation in cash, those animals were hunted by hunters. I know this might not be consistent with the current regulations, but it's something to look at. If an elephant gets out, it will get out again, because they're highly intelligent animals. So the best is to shoot the elephant, but let a hunter shoot it, charge them a lot of money, and let the community benefit from that, because they're the ones that suffer the damage. So maybe this is something that your committee could consider as well and discuss with both departments, because this might work, particularly the communities that are bordering on the Kruger Park. It might be better to make a living out of hunting and ecotourism in the end than it would be for livestock farming. And a campfire system similar to what they use in Zimbabwe might be something to consider. Again, it would have to be you know, discussed between the two departments. So I think there are things that can be done now, and I think that's important. I agree with the honourable member here that it would be not the right thing to wait, but if there are things that can be done now, we should do them. And I think that's where your advice as a portfolio committee and the two departments working together would be something well worth considering, because taking, for example, fencing, etc., we might be able to get something in place to start managing this problem and not have to wait until we've got these norms and standards published. Thank you.
No, that's what is troubling me. You're saying these things. These things are supposed to be done. I'm expecting a comment from the Department of Agriculture, Forest and Fisheries on these norms to guide us going forward. Because the challenge that we have is that the problem is ongoing as we speak now. Now, rather than we get to be hearing you saying all these things, it's like us also here saying them, but the department is not doing anything. Now, that's the problem that I have. Mrs. Carroll, you want to say the last word before another very last round?
Chair, I thought I'll just mention that with the TOPS amendment process that we're going in, the proposal has been made linked to, similar to the campfire situation in Zimbabwe, that we amend the regulations to allow especially communities bordering protected areas that they will be able to, instead of the damage-causing animal just be killed, that they will have the option to get a foreign client into hand to sort of assist in terms of reacting to their damage. I just thought I'll add that. Thanks.
Mrs. Palliser, I saw your hand, Mrs. Diabro.
Thank you, Chairperson. I don't think we are getting the real answers here, Chairperson. Saying that, I was just wondering, how come the provinces have their own legislature without having a national framework guideline? It is not making sense. It doesn't make sense, that answer to us. It is misleading us as this portfolio. That's the first one. Because if provinces were all along the problem implementing their own legislatures, why didn't the national department call them in? Because they've got MINTEX, there are MIMEX. How come this was never addressed? So it doesn't really make sense to me. What I also want to know that, do the department really have inspectors, or do they really have human capacity to implement all these laws of damage-causing animals, if they are shifting and say that provinces are the ones who are responsible for this? You know, Chapman, we are in another portfolio committees, and we were having this very same exercise in correctional services. When we were addressing issues, officials were telling us that no, it's the other department, it's DPW, it's DPW. And we called a joint committee meeting. DPW was also there. The tune just changed. There was no more DPW was the cause of trouble, DPW was the cause of this, and DPW was the cause of that. This is the very same exercise we are going through, because if we can call provinces, those responsible, to come here to have a joint meeting with us, the tune will change. Because I can't how come that provinces do have their own legislation without having a national framework? Thanks, Chair.
Mr. Brown.
Chairperson, this the good lady spoke about the introduction of game farms in what one could term traditionally farming areas. That has had a disastrous impact. Problem here is this, Chairperson, that if you are living in a township and you want to start a shebeen within the residential area, there are processes that you need to follow. For example, apply for rezoning in terms of the town planning scheme and things like that. We don't seem to have that kind of thing. A person can buy land and decide that he's going to game fence it and bring in game. Now, for example, if you take the blue wildebeest, the blue wildebeest is a carrier of a disease called malignant keteral fever. In Afrikaans we call it snotziekte. And the blue wildebeest will not get that disease itself, but it passes it on to livestock, especially cattle. And we've had cases where farmers have lost thousands of rands in cattle that had to be put down because that died because of this particular illness. My problem, Chairperson, is the mandate of the Department of Agriculture, as you mentioned earlier, is not being implemented by the department. The department's task should be to see to it that food security is priority number one, and all those things that impede upon realizing that ideal or that mandate needs to be looked at. And I feel, Chairperson, that before a person turns a commercial farm into a game farm, there should be some processes that need to be followed before the person that person is allowed to do that. The other problem, Chairperson, is again the age-old one, and that is, yes, there was a time when we had the stock inspector, and I still remember that there was a massive foot and mouth outbreak that started in the olden days in the Witwatersrand area, and you had stock inspectors manning roadblocks, and you were asked, have you perhaps got any meat with you, or are you carrying any flesh product, you know, that sort of thing. We don't have those things these days, Chairperson. You take, for example, the recent Rift Valley outbreaks in our country. There was no way that ordinary people in the rural areas could hear that, listen, if an animal has died, be careful, it might be contaminated. In the process, we lost a number of people last year as a result of the outbreak. So, Chairperson, it's all very well to have all these beautiful laws and regulations and everything. A question I always ask is, do we have the implementers? Do we have the people that must do the job, that can show us the results on the ground? And that is where our problem lies. That is the devil in the details. So, Chairperson, you know, I'm very wary of over-regulation. Sometimes it's required, but we've got to be very careful that before we regulate ourselves out of an industry, let us be very careful. Let's look at it very carefully, Chair. I'm going to end off with a little joke, Chair. You know, a surveyor pitched up on a farmer's farm, and he tells the farmer that, look, man, I've got these documents here, I've got to survey this land of yours. And the farmer says, listen here, this is my land, nobody told me that anybody is going to come here to survey my land. So he insisted that this is now an official document from government and you can't stop me from doing what I want to do here. He said, fine, carry on. So he opens up the gates and he goes into a camp there where there were ostriches. And when he started now, you know, putting up his cameras and things, this ostrich charged at him. And he's now running to the farmer. He says, please, man, help me. This ostrich is going to kill me. He says, well, show him your papers. Tell him the government told you you've got to come in into this camp. That's a position, Chairperson. Unfortunately, these animals, let's face it, many of these animals can outwit you. A jackal will outwit you. But unfortunately, Chairperson, we have to have certain things in place that we used to do that worked in the past. I cannot absolutely agree, Chairperson, at the fact that farmers were allowed to kill, especially jackal and roeikat caracal, that has contributed to the present problem we have. I don't know, Chair. I can't understand, because in those years, Chairperson, the farmer did not lose stock to these two predators. Well, I don't know. Perhaps their instincts have made them develop. I don't know who lectured to them to develop alternative sciences or alternative ways of doing things. But Jefferson, if something had worked up to now, why can it not continue working from now onwards? Why must we go and look at new things, new methods and things? And this business, Chairperson, about compensation. You know, when there's a drought in the country, Chairperson, that individual that is a victim of the drought will get assistance after a season or two. So I want to venture to predict that the compensation that's being spoken of here will be very good on paper, very good to read. When it comes to implementing it, Chairperson, the people are sent from, you know, Herwarts to Derwarts, you know, from one end to the other, and they just don't get that assistance. Let us do the things that need to be done. and let us do it speedily. All these things, Shepherdson, cannot wait for you until you have prepared your regulations and you have done this and that and the other. Those things are going to happen. They're going to carry on. What I'm saying, Shepherdson, is the Department of Agriculture must make up its mind whether we should not have some or other regulations in terms of creating new game farms. Because they come slap bang within a commercial area, and of course what happens there, they are very, very conscious of not wanting anything to come in or out or whatever. And in this process, Chairperson, the commercial farmers next door are in deep trouble. We were at Shamwari some time ago, and all the small farmers around Shamwari that were making a living out of this, Chairperson, a bit of agriculture, stock farming and stuff, all those farmers have virtually gone. What has happened? Shamwari has taken that land over, most of the land. And there are no more stock farmers left. They cannot afford to be stock farming. So let us be very careful what we allow into the country. And finally, Chair, who are the majority of the game farmers in our country? They don't live there on the game farm. They've got damaging directors there. They are people, the guys with the big names, you know, from overseas and all over, that are owning these luxury places. And it is not contributing, in my way of thinking, Jefferson, to the real issues in our country. Thank you.
I think that was the very last comment. I guess the issue here really talks to prevention being better than cure. Whether you have to wait until something happens, then the norms and the regulations come in. As we speak, many members here have alluded to this fact. I hear the lady, Mrs. Carroll, is saying before end of December or before 2011 is gone, those norms shall have been delivered for argument's sake in terms of, you know, passing through. Now, even if that happens, still the question remains about the implementability of these norms and standards. And again, whom are they expected to be directed to? Who is supposed to implement? You know, this is a very interesting session. You hear people really, you know, coming up with all sorts of, you know, adages here, and also expressions. You know, Mama, you know, talks to Mama Twala, you know, being a witch, you know.
We don't believe it in anything.
That's what this session is really, you know, come up with. Which also, you know, takes me to that old, you know, reading of Animal Farm. Which I'm just making a note for myself, you know, that one really has to go back and read. But also a very interesting point raised by Mama Paliso about the provincial legislation. To an extent, even at local government, the bylaws, because one of the major problems that we have currently with stray animals, not only being you know, damaged by your predators, but also the extent in which they wander about. The points raised by Bishop Tolo about protection of those animals in the olden days compared to today's situation, wherein they are literally all over, to a point where they even eat anything and everything. Granted, this may not necessarily relevant to the issues, because what we are about, we're about predators and the damages that they cause to livestock. But related again, you know, how these animals, they get to be wild out there, to a point where they even eat anything and everything that comes their way, plastics and they get to die at the end. Now, if you like, those could be other forms of predators. Because those directly kill, you know, those animals. Now, a very important point also has been raised about who really is on the receiving end. And that really begs the same question about who is expected to implement. You know, I'm not forgetting the words expressed by Mr. Abram here that says, you know, these predators, they're working overtime. They have a job to do, and they know exactly what that job is. And they don't even know about, let alone caring about those norms and standards. Precisely because they're not going to read them. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's allow Bishop Tolo very last, and then.
I think it's very important. I just find our conversation. I think last year or this year, many rhino killed, and I just find out how many in number those rhino killed, and how many remaining. And those people who killed the rhino, where are those people? Because we're looking, according to myself, they must get life sentence in prison. Because those people, they're making our country poor. Somebody here was talking about the tourism, people looking from outside to come to South Africa to look and see the animals. But some people, they're just killed. Now, how many remaining and how many killed? And who, those people who killed this land, where is those people? And that kind of question, Jefferson.
You also have to bear with us, Mrs. Carroll. We will ask and comment on directly related and also on those that are not necessarily related. It is of interest to members of parliament. That's generally how we deal with issues. But of importance also, we need to focus ourselves. We are about the norms and standards, but of course, you are at liberty to respond to those that are not necessarily directly related. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll do my best to respond to all the issues. In terms of provincial legislation versus national legislation, I by no means trying to mislead the committee. It is a reality that we're dealing with in terms of environmental issues. It's environment and conservation is a concurrent competence in terms of the constitution, and the provincial departments have the right to make their own legislation, and they also exercise that right by making their own legislation. And the National Environmental Management Biodiversity Act was only promulgated in 2004, and that was really the first national act that addressed biodiversity issues per se. Before that, we had the Environmental Conservation Act and so forth. It was more focused in terms of on EIA issues, the environmental impact assessment issues and so forth. So NEMBO was the first national attempt to address national biodiversity issues in terms of legislation. So before that, the provinces had their ordinances and so forth, and they were implementing those. They still continue to implement it because it's a concurrent function. They are allowed to have their own legislation and they can implement it. The damage-causing animal issue is very complex, and I mentioned that in 2006 there was a workshop where all stakeholders were involved. It's not a simple matter to address, and because of the lack of a national approach to deal with it, we developed this document. And although there's a lot of comments on it and criticisms towards it, I think at least it is a document that's on the table that now gets discussed and get proper comment on and so forth, where in the past it wasn't there. There was nothing on the table. So, yes, the national framework wasn't there in the past for the provinces. So they managed the situation based on their provincial ordinances, which is their right to do. And it has its own complexities because of the concurrent competence. If we can change the constitution, it will make my life easier. But I don't think that is currently in the, you know, in anyone's scope to address that issue. I can just mention that when we did the list for threatened or protected species in terms of the Biodiversity Act, the process was after 2004 now, between 2004 and 2007 when everything was published. Caracal was in fact on the list originally when it was published for comment. And based on the response from stakeholders, it was removed. It wasn't in the final list that was published because of the implications in terms of the farmers and so forth. So I can just mention that nationally, you know, there were proposals that it should be regulated nationally, but it didn't happen in the end. In terms of implementation and the various comments made by the committee member, and also by the chair, I cannot say honestly that we have enough people, enough knowledgeable, highly experienced people currently on the ground. But that is to do with budget and so forth. So if maybe the committee can assist us when we motivate for more funding in terms of that regard, because it's a reality for all of us. What we're trying to do is to sort of pool resources and to get farmers more involved, because at the end we would like the farmers to also support the implementation of something that might work to improve their situation. It's not something we want to enforce the whole time. We want people to comply because it benefits them. And at the moment it doesn't look like that's the situation, but that is what we want to work towards. Because I don't know if we're going to get millions and millions to address our resource issues, but that's why we need to get the stakeholders on board and willing to comply and to cooperate and to together find solutions. Unfortunately, we have a history of enforcement. We have to force people always to comply. We need people to be compliant and not kick against all possible means of regulation. So that's all I can say that in terms of that. And yes. And then there was just an issue around implementation. In the presentation, when I speak about issuing authorities, that is the provincial government conservation departments. The national department, we make policy, regulations, legislation, and so forth, but it's mainly implemented in the provinces. We are only an issuing authority where organs of state is involved. For example, if Sand Parks needs to take action, we will give them permits in that regard. But because of the concurrent function, most implementation happens in the provinces, as with agriculture, I think. And then the last issue on rhino poaching. I've got some stats here that I just want to refer to quickly. At the end of last year, there was 333 rhinos poached, but we have a population of about 20,000. So in terms of the growth rate, they grow at about 6% per annum. So it's a concern, but the poaching and so forth hasn't had a negative impact in terms of the population growth of rhino. And then most cases is obviously in Kruger National Park, been reported there, and then also Limpopo and Northwest has high numbers with poaching there. And then in last year there were 162 arrests made in terms of those three poaching incidences or illegal hunting incidences. I've got a little presentation here, but it's not really mine, so I wouldn't want to give it to you, but that's just in short. So in terms of the response by the department, a National Wildlife Crime Reaction Unit was established to address it, and we developed a rhino strategy that addresses some key issues that needs immediate action and then longer term actions as well to address the problem. So the unit has been established and has been working since last year. Yes. So that's just in short the department's response in terms of the rhino poaching incidences. Chair, I hope I addressed everything. I don't know if Keith wants to add something. Thanks.
Where do we go from here? No, there's only one meeting here. Where do we go from here? And what time frames do we have? I hear you saying something about by year end, there shall have been some conclusion on these processes, in other words, on the norms and standards. Where do we go from here? What are the processes going forward?
Thanks, Chair. As I mentioned, we are still busy consolidating all the comments received, and then we'll have to go through a process to consider the comments and give an indication or recommendation in terms of the whether a certain amendments or so forth should be accepted or rejected and so on. And then after we've done that, gone through that process, the document will be amended, and we, the department, plan to have a workshop with stakeholders once we have an amended document to just give them an opportunity again to have a look at it. And recently our portfolio committee also requested that all subordinate legislation be circulated to them. So we will also then hopefully have a briefing session with our portfolio committee to inform them in terms of the process and the status of the document. But that amended document will then have to go through our decision-making process again with the provinces, the Working Group 1, MINTEC, and MINMEC, before it will be submitted to Minister for sign-off. So it's quite a lengthy process, and as I mentioned, we received really a lot of comments on the document that needs to be considered. So that part of the process will take up quite some time, taking into consideration, unfortunately, this is not the only issue we're dealing with as the section responsible for this document. So, that is why I'm saying by the end of 2011. But that's in broad the process that we're going through. I don't know if you have any comments on that.
What do you do in the meantime?
Yes. Yes, Chair, maybe I didn't understand your question. What do we do in the meantime while we have lots of meetings and so forth? Basically, the status quo remains. Insofar as Jackal and Caracal is concerned, if I can be that specific, provincial legislation requirements must be adhered to. In terms of the threatened or protected species regulations, the requirements must be adhered to. You need a permit to manage the DCAs, and you need to comply with those requirements in the regulations. Mm-hmm. This document is not in place yet. That is, I think, so the status quo will be maintained until, in the meantime, we are addressing certain community-related concerns. That's a priority for us as a department in terms of conflict issues of protected areas, and that will receive immediate attention to try and relieve that pressure. But in terms of the management, that will continue. There are lots of concerns, especially because the regulations allow for the use of soft traps. Just gin traps are prohibited, and there are a lot of concern about that. So the provinces are under a lot of pressure to take immediate action in terms of that. So that is a concern from our side as well, but this document is not in place yet, so it cannot be enforced at this point in time.
think, you know, in the interim, what we can do, and we're looking at this as well, things like the specifications for these traps. Let's develop them and test them so that these things are all in place. There's no reason why we can't do this. We're collecting information at the moment, and we're trying to get funding for the Predator Management Forum to really collect all the information. We don't want to repeat research, but we need to have good examples of and get them documented of where, you know, we've got, for example, farms where they've been using alpacas to control jackals, and the alpacas have been very effective. So we need to just document all this so that we don't wait until something's in place and then start doing it. And it gives us time now to maybe develop specs for the trap so that we can give people these specs to see whether we can't regulate it in that way. So we mustn't wait for this. We must do all these bits and pieces in the meantime from our side. That would also be the fencing again. I cannot, in my position, take any decisions or anything, but I'll report back to the department that we have a serious look at the whole issue of fencing as well, so that we don't, let's see what we can do in the meantime proactively.
So that's my major interest. Whether the Department of Agriculture, Forests and Fisheries does have a program dealing with the matters that we're dealing with. I guess we might also wish to hear more of that when we get the strat plan and budget from the department in the next few days. But this is a matter that we also would wish you could just have it as food for thought as the department presents its strat plan and budget in the next few days. How about if we conclude it on that note, members, and then we thank you both, Mrs. Carroll. I didn't hear the name,
yeah.
Mr.
Yeah. Chair,
my name is Tia. Chair,
my name is Keith Ramsey.
Thank you. Mr. Ramsey and Mrs. Carroll, Mr. Adams and Ralph, thanks for your time. We will just run quickly whilst everybody else is packing a few housekeeping ones. Next week we are invited by AgriSA to its conference. It's taking place here at Somerset West. It's on Monday and